Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast that gets to know women we admire up close and personal, as we share open conversations with them about their lives and their influences. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Fee Glover. Welcome, Fee. Thanks for your time.
It's a pleasure. Okay, go. Yes.
So, Fee Glover is an award-winning broadcaster on radio and television, as well as an author, a journalist, and a podcaster. You are one of the UK's most powerful female voices, Fee. How does that make you feel?
Well, you see, I wouldn't say that I was, actually. And that term powerful, do you know, the Radio Times did a survey about 10 years ago, which ended up being billed as a kind of top 10 of the most powerful voices in radio. And I went in at number 9. And everyone who was in the survey had been asked who they thought was an influential voice in radio. So, you know, we were swimming in our own what's it. That's what that survey was about. And it gets quoted a lot now. And I always feel like saying, no, that's just not, because it sounds like they went out and interviewed kind of 10,000 people and said, who's the most influential voice in radio? But they didn't. They asked about 20 of us who we thought were influential. So I always, when anyone ever puts in an intro, you know, that I'm a powerful voice in radio, I always feel like a total fraud right from the word go. So I don't feel very powerful. The stuff that I broadcast now is probably powerful, but that doesn't make me powerful at all.
I think you're being very modest there. We think you're influential and powerful. And we've seen you on television from Bake Off to Comic Relief, The Apprentice, Newsnight. And heard you on BBC Radio 4, Saturday Live and Broadcasting House. You've been on 5 Live with News and Politics, on Breakfast on GLR, now BBC London, on Current Affairs on The World Service, and now even on your own podcast. So where did that all begin, V?
Well, that's spread over 25 years. So I started as a local radio trainee reporter. So I did lots of hospital radio when I was first working in London. I'd done quite a lot of student journalism when I was at university, and I'd done it all unbelievably deliberately so that I could try and get a place on the local radio trainee scheme. It's the only thing that I wanted to do, was go and work as a radio reporter in the local radio BBC network. And I look back on that, and actually, you know, knowing lots of young people now, generation below me, and I think, oh, what was it? Why did I think that that was the only thing that I ever wanted to do? It's quite strange, actually. But I just honed in on that. So I got all the right qualifications, you know, did all the right type of stuff and was really lucky, got a place on the course. So I started off in local radio. So I worked in Somerset, Northampton and Hull, and then I went to GLR from there. And I did always want to come back to London. I've been living in London, you know, for a long time anyway. So I enjoyed my time in the regions. I don't think the regions really enjoyed having me there. And I just really, really, really wanted to go and work at GLR.
I don't think it's luck. I think it's complete talent. And you're well recognised for the Listening Project radio show. Can you share more about that?
So the Listening Project is the most remarkable thing to work on. It is so simple. It's just conversation. We're recording thousands of conversations between two people who know and love each other. They have to talk about something that matters to both of them. We record the conversations. We play some of them out on Radio 4 and local radio. And then we're creating this incredible sound archive at the British Library. And the whole point of it is to record modern Britain as we see it. So it is a unique oral history project in that respect, because we don't say to people, you know, you live in Northampton, you must talk about, you know, the elements of industry that have changed over here in the last 30 years. We don't go to Humberside and say, you've got to talk about the docks. We don't say anything like that. We just say to people, hello, we're pitching up in Northampton. What would you like to talk about? What would you like to tell us about from your lives? So we are, it's basically a time capsule. It's thousands of audio time capsules. That's what we're after. We're based on an American project called StoryCorps, which is massive in America. And they allowed us to do the same thing over here. So don't go thinking that we just stole it. They have been going for about 15 years. They've got 40,000 conversations stored in the American Library of Congress. So I like to think, well, if they've got 40,000, you know, we should aim to be beating that. That will keep me in work until I can speak no longer. But it would be amazing to be able to carry on, actually. I think one of the most important parts of it is that people really enjoy doing it. And it's very rare to work on a project in radio which really gives something back. You know, radio is a very disposable thing. We send it out into the ether, poof, it's gone. So to do something where there's like a hard copy of it forevermore is really lovely, really lovely.
It's very special, isn't it? And will people find it and look at what we did, what we talked about, how many years to come?
Well, I mean, we always say it's for future generations because it's a digital archive. I mean, you know, it could last forever and ever and ever. And the people who are using it at the moment will be different to the people who use it in 100, 200 years' time. There's all kinds of stuff in there. So I hope it does get well used. I'm sure it will do. I mean, if you think back, if we could go back to, let's say, Roman Britain, and, you know, we know the basic history of it, you know, we can look at the artefacts, you know, we can still see some of the remains, you can walk around some of the buildings. But imagine if you could hear the conversations, you know, that would be as entertaining, fascinating and informative as any of those kind of big building blocks of history. So that's what we're doing with the Listening Project.
So your voice will be there forever.
Well, mine won't. No, you see, mine won't at all because the archive is storing the conversations. I'm not in them at all. No. No, people be fee-hoo. God, I should think probably by the end of next year, Nikki. No, I'm not in them at all.
Oh, we'll have to change that. So you were a director on the board of Sound Women, the charity to improve the profile of women in radio that we actually met through, and that's made a huge difference.
Well, we did have an impact. So we're no longer in existence as a lobbying organisation. We did some really fantastic research to launch the organisation because there was still this extraordinary myth in radio, particularly in commercial radio, that people didn't like to hear women's voices on air. Nobody really knows who started that rumour, but it's just not true, actually, really, really not true. But obviously because it permeated through many layers of management and, you know, advertising sales departments and stuff, a lot of women were finding it very difficult to get on air. So we did some research at the start that showed that only one in five voices across Britain and across all the networks was female at any given time, which is just rubbish. You know, the listenership is 50-50. Quite often it's more women listening than men. Women like to hear women on air. So it was just bunkum, you know, that we'd started to kind of regress into this man cave of audio. So we launched and we made a big impact. And actually the BBC was amazing and really, really picked up the gauntlet of equality. And Tony Hall was fantastic and immediately said, yeah, that's rubbish. Let's do something to change it. So lots of schemes were put in place across the BBC to help women get on air. And the thing about on-air talent is, you know, there are lots of very successful female broadcasters out there, particularly on the national networks. And, you know, I've worked across the national networks myself. You kind of did have to prove that you were, you know, better than the guys in order to get the shows and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's 2017. It shouldn't be that way. Women and men are, you know, as talented. So don't make women work that much harder in order to get in front of the microphone.
Very right. Women are now appearing on weekend shows, breakfast, primetime and podcasts, including yourself. So do you think you were literally in the right place at the right time?
Gosh, what, all the way back when? GLR was a really forward-thinking, dynamic radio station. So there were some really amazing people working there. I think when I joined, you had just across the schedules, Chris Evans, Danny Baker, Gary Crowley, Johnny Walker, Tommy Vance. But also you had Diana Luke and Emma Freud and Sandy Waugh. It was just an absolute hotbed of enthusiasm and dynamism. And I certainly turned up as the most hardworking kind of intern that you could ever have. I mean, you know, I remember I'd be working at Hull during the week, you know, doing my proper radio trainee job, and I'd go and do two shifts at GLR over the weekend. You know, I'd get in my battered Volvo 240, yay, car of dreams, you know, and drive back up to Hull at like 5 a.m. on Monday, you know, to make it for a shift there. So right place, right time? No, I think right time in my life to work unbelievably hard and prove that I wanted it. But I'm not sure You know, I don't think, I mean, yes, you can always embrace opportunities, but the kind of right place, right time thing, I think it suggests that for some people that will never happen, and you should never think that. You know, you should just keep going until you find the right place and it is the right time.
So it's sheer grit and determination as well, isn't it? How would you describe yourself as a broadcaster then, Fee?
Quite frequently, as you can tell by this answer, all over the place. The thing that I love most about broadcasting, because it's almost impossible to know what it is that other people might like about you. I think once you start to do that, you're also in a slightly weird form of madness, actually. The things that I really like about broadcasting, though, are I like being in a situation with a person where I can really ask them whatever I want. That's what I love about a radio studio. That's what I've loved about having shows of my own. Do you know, I just love the medium. I mean, I can talk, I know that, but I also really like listening to people. I find people just endlessly fascinating. I can't think of a time when I'm not going to be interested in somebody else's life. So it's just really simple things like that. I listen to other broadcasters and I think, God, I really don't have, you know, what other broadcasters have. I'm not a silky smooth broadcaster. You know, people who've listened to me regularly over the years would recognise that I haven't quite been on enough professional training courses. You know, there are often quite a lot of gaps. And when I was manning the desk myself, actually, that was dreadful. I was quite bad at driving desks.
I definitely think you're super smooth. And I've heard you say you think you're cookie strange before, but is that what you think? We think you're intelligent, calm and unflappable, but that's not how you read yourself.
No, you see, I'm not. I'm really not calm and unflappable. And the shows that I've done that have been the most successful, so that's just like taking the data, they're always at very odd times of the day or night, and they're really never calm. They're never the calm shows. So Sunday Service, which I did with Charlie Whelan and Andrew Pearce on Five Live, that turned into an absolute hit. That was really not calm at all. And the Late Night Live show that I did on Five Live with David Croft on the sports desk, that was from 10 till 1. We used to call the last hour of the programme Beyond Thunderdome because we just did whatever we wanted. Those are the shows that have been the most successful. So they're really not calm, unflappable shows at all.
So I love your new Fortunately podcast, Double Act. Are you enjoying that with Jane?
Well, to work with Jane Garvey, and basically we sit there, we have a hot beverage in front of us and we shoot the breeze. So that's not work, kids, is it? That's not work at all. We're choosing bits that we've heard on Radio 4 and actually some of the other BBC networks. And we're just saying what we like about them and trying to draw attention to, you know, bits and pieces that don't always, you know, get flagged up. It's just bliss. It's absolute bliss. So Garv can just make me laugh, you know, until I wet myself. She is so funny. She is naturally so funny. And also on Woman's Hour, she has to be the host of Woman's Hour, which I think she does unbelievably well. I really love listening to her Woman's Hours. But she can't really release the full force of the Garvey. And I think in the podcast, she's just beginning to. So she's so unguarded, fantastically unguarded. And her humour is so sharp. Yep, it's blissful.
You are both very funny on there, actually. And it's giving everyone an insight into what happens here at the BBC, you know, in terms of the shows and everything. I think it's a brilliant concept. Now, you wrote a book of your travel experiences visiting radio around the world. I mean, that must have been fascinating. Was that a commissioned? How did you do it?
Gosh, well, that came out of being on Five Live, and a very lovely woman who used to listen to some of the shows that I did on Five Live, she was working for Ebury Press, part of Random House, and she just phoned up and said, do you think you have a book in you? To which I, without even thinking, said yes. Without even thinking, do I, actually? Should we think that question through? Do I have a book inside me? But, you know, I was of that age where I just, well, yes, I'll do anything. I'll do absolutely anything. Enthusiastic about anything. And so I do remember that phone call very clearly and going away and thinking, oh, OK, I've got to really think of something now. But she was fantastic. I should give her a name, Hannah McDonald. She's a great editor. And she just said, you know, you always have to write about something that you love and something that you know. And I was doing the travel show at the time on BBC Two. So I genuinely, wherever I went in the world, took my little wind up radio with me and just always listen to local radio stations to try and keep me sane, because our schedule on the travel show was ridiculous, you know, in order to make the most of our services and not cost the BBC too much money. You know, we'd fly to Australia and then we'd fly back and do a film in Budapest, and then we'd go to Mexico, and then we'd go straight on to India, you know, usually in the back of the plane. You know, it was just like pounding, and radio just kept me sane. Always listening to the local radio really kept me sane. So I just said, can I write about that? And she said, terrific idea. It's a love letter to local radio around the world. And do you know what? I'm really glad I wrote it now, because that world has gone. It's actually properly gone. And there are loads of things that are amazing about the advances of the digital age. And this is one of them. You know, you can have an idea for a podcast, a program essentially, and you can make it yourself, you edit it yourself, you put it out there to the world yourself. I've got absolutely no complaints about that. I'm not a Luddite at all in that respect. But the thing that we've lost is proper local radio around the world, because it's just too expensive, doesn't serve a big enough audience. But it was just the stuff of characterful dreams. You know, local radio was just always full of people who really overcared about their local community. Quite often people who were beyond eccentric. You know, even the adverts just, you know, were daft but engaging. And I just loved everything about it. So I'm really glad I wrote that book. But if you read it now, really parts of it will just make no sense.
Now, we'd like to know more about your influences and your true passions. What do you get up to when you're not broadcasting? Do you?
Well, I sleep. I sleep mainly. So I've got quite young children. They are coming up for 12, coming up for 9. And I had them quite late in life. So I'm not joking. When I'm not working, I'm sleeping. Or I'm doing something with the kids. I've got no interesting hobbies to report whatsoever. And I think I really enjoy doing the stuff, all of the stuff with the kids. And I'm lucky at the moment that they really like doing stuff that I like doing. I'm aware that that may change at any time. And, you know, if my son does suddenly say, you know, I want to get into, I don't know, BMX biking or go-karting or something like that, you know, that's a concrete surface and an out-of-town theme park, I'm going to hate it. But at the moment, you know, we're happy all just kind of piddling along doing family stuff. But I lead a very boring life outside work, and I'm not trying to, you know, pal up to people by saying that.
That's it. That's probably a very honest of most people's lives. Now, what's been the proudest moment of your career?
I am really proud of the Listening Project, you know, for all the reasons that we talked about. You know, it really touches people. I think it's really effective. I think it uses radio in the best possible way. I love everything about it. So I'm very, very proud. But also, I created and present a programme on the BBC World Service called My Perfect Country. And I know it sounds a bit boastful to have said that, you know, I created and present. But actually, it's the first programme that is genuinely, I really wanted to make it. You know, I am a presenter before being a producer, and I'm really proud that we made that happen. So it's a very simple concept. It's looking at how we would create a perfect country, and we do that through looking at parts of the world where policy has worked. So in a world of news, which I've always been in, which can be very gloomy, we tend to report things when they fail. It's a programme that says, well, actually, there are lots of people across the world who get up in the morning and go, how can I solve this thing? You know, how can I make this work? How can I make it better? So we go around the world looking at those projects and those public policies. And then we work out why, if they work in one place, they can't work in another. And it's so gloriously uplifting, actually, because we hear so many stories of, you know, people who've made things happen, countries that have made things happen, and it slightly restores your faith in public policy. So I am very proud of that. I am very proud of that little show.
Little show. And so you should be. Little show, my goodness. Now, you should also be proud of the fact you've won gold, silver and bronze awards for broadcasting. I mean, it's like the Olympics, isn't it?
Yes, I have won some awards. It is very nice. It's very nice to win things.
Now, can you please share your new radio series, Glass Half Full?
Glass Half Full. It's about whether or not you look at the world through the prism of optimism or pessimism. So it's a Radio 4 discussion programme. And we took four big subjects, lined up a group of positive thinkers versus negative thinkers, a couple of people in the middle, and we asked the audience to do it as a bit of a thought experiment. So we talked about whether or not we could all expect a healthier future, whether technology is actually good for our kids, whether or not a population of 9 billion is sustainable on the planet. So you can see where we're going, big, big things. And also whether or not gender equality is within reach. And we asked the audience to really kind of etch a sketch their mind, wipe it completely clean of whether or not they usually immediately go no or yes, and then see whether or not they were swayed by the arguments. And in fact, in every single programme, we did sway the audience. So they started off thinking, this is how I think about this topic. And by the end, we had changed more minds than had stayed.
And are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I am so both, in a kind of relentlessly over-enthusiastic way. So I can, when I'm doom-laden, I can be so doom-laden. I just eviscerate every single element of positivity in the room. But at the same time, when I'm positive about something, it's like a puppy dog who hasn't seen their owner all day. I think actually sometimes that's the problem. It's the hazard of the job, actually. I think when you've been a journalist for too long, you really can argue any corner. You really don't know what you think about anything, because your reaction whenever you hear an argument is to think of what the counter-argument would be.
That's definitely the kookiness then, isn't it? That's what it is. So you've studied classic civilization and philosophy. Is that why you enjoy the subjects, do you think, that stir emotion and get the people to talk?
Yes, enormously. And I'm really glad I studied classics and philosophy at university. I went to the University of Kent at Canterbury, and I originally went to read film and drama. And I did 2 weeks of film and drama and realised that I was just way out of my depth in the drama department. You know, I'd been to the kind of hokey provincial school, you know, that thought it was exciting to put on something by Noel Coward. And I was up against all these people who'd done method acting, you know, and were from the Brechtian school. And I just remember sitting in a seminar in about week two just thinking, oh, I am so not going to enjoy this. So I changed to classics and philosophy, and I am so glad that I did, because for me anyway, studying the classical world is like having a permanent friend. You know, it's a place to always go back to, because it was the most extraordinary time in history. If you think of all of the literature, the plays, the politics that came out of Athens in the 5th century. So the fact that it's, you know, the crucible of democracy, interestingly, democracy didn't last, you know, worth considering that point as well. If you look to the wider sphere, just all of the plays by Euripides and Aeschylus and all the rest of it, all human life is contained within there. All the lessons of universal truths are contained within there. And I just really, I love having that place in my head where you can always reference anything that's happening in our modern world back to something before. And lots of historians, like proper historians, I'm not a historian, that's just what I studied years ago, but lots of historians say the same thing, that if you find a place in history that really, really fires up your imagination, you know, it is like you've made a new friend. So yeah, I absolutely love it. And the philosophy, I was so bad at it, Nikki. So I actually got an essay back from a fantastic philosophy don at Kent. I don't know whether you can call them dons outside Cambridge and Oxford, but anyway, lecturer. And it was I was doing modern moral philosophy, and he actually he drew a line through the whole essay and just put it at the bottom, "This is wrong." I always thought the whole point of philosophy is that you could try and argue anything. So I was just very bad at philosophy. But again, I learned all those really kind of big basics, you know, the big kind of theories of it. And I always quite like playing around with those in my head. I mean, there's a lot to be said for modern moral philosophy.
I don't think you were wrong at all. I think he was definitely an empty glass sort of person, wasn't he? So can we share more about your passions? What makes you truly happy?
Well, I'm going to say something very naff, you know, which is my kids, but, you know, they are absolutely my pot of joy. But I know that everybody would say that. So I'm also going to say some quite random things. I really, really love crisps. I really love crisps. So I could eat, like, not one of those small, reasonable bags, but I think they call them sharing bags, don't they? I could eat one of those a day. And crisps make me happy. Really fantastic crime fiction. makes me happy. So again, I mean, I get a bit obsessed, you know, with different authors at different times. I think Ian Rankin was on the verge of getting a restraining order out against me. I love good crime fiction. It's method, results, conclusion. Just, I can't get enough of that. And I really like autumn.
And cycling. Are we allowed to talk about this?
You can talk about my
What have we got on the table?
So I've got a gold bike helmet, which I bought just at a place up in North London years ago. And I didn't think, I mean, it's lovely.
it's
very reflective, which is very good. Actually, you know, cycling in London is not the safest thing to do. And it's very, very beaten up and battered. I've seen quite a few more on the roads recently. But for a while, it was definitely, you know, a slight one-off. And I worry that I caused more accidents than prevented, because people used to shout, you know, where'd you get it, love? And so a couple of people shouted very rude things about it as well.
It is reflective. So you do have a hobby. And
cycling's not a hobby. No, because if cycling was a hobby, I would have to have a really, you know, fantastically overpriced carbon fibre bike, which I don't have. I've got one of those set up and beg ones. And I'd have to have a lot of things in Lycra, which I don't have. I do not have Lycra. And I'd have to go and do like insane distances, you know, and cycle to Brussels and back in a day, wouldn't I? And I don't do that either. And sometimes, Nikki, if a hill is a little bit too steep, I walk up it. So it's not a hobby. Exactly.
It's not a hobby, but that obviously works off any crisps, because I can't see any evidence.
Well, maybe, yes.
Any evidence, yes, of that. Are there any things that have influenced your life, like a mantra?
Oh, do you know what? It's just the really boring, you know, be nice and work hard. And actually, I was going to look round secondary schools for my son last year. And I mean, the mantra is a very prevalent modern thing, isn't it? Just bloody everywhere. T-shirts, doors, on your napkins in restaurants. There was one poster that actually really stuck with me in one of our local schools, and it said, be your best self even when no one's looking. And I thought, actually, I really like that. I really like, because that's hard to do. It's very easy, you know, especially if you do quite a public job, you know, to do the jazz hands of, you know, being fantastic and wonderful. But it's not always very easy to do that when nobody's watching you. So I'd put that in there. But just the be nice to people and just really work as hard as you can. You know, it's a winning combination.
Oh, fantastic, Fi. We've really got to know you here. So what's next for you? Any more books, podcasts? No time.
No. Do you know what? I'm really happy with my lot at the moment, actually. The Listening Project does take up quite a lot of my time, and I'm very happy for it to do that. My Perfect Country goes out on the World Service twice a year. Fortunately, podcast, you know, I'm still on a school run most days of the week. So that is absolutely, you know, I'm grateful for the work. I really love the work. I'm just going to say I'm really happy with my lot. Thank you very much.
You've got enough on your plate. Lastly, what would you say to other women wanting to change their life or career?
Well, I would say, and it's a really difficult thing to do, but I would say really just have confidence in yourself. So to go right back to the beginning of our chat, I don't know what it was that made me want to go into radio so young and be so certain about it. But I just had the confidence to believe that it could happen. And I think that confidence often leaves you. I think it's a youthful thing, that just ridiculous kind of I can do it feeling. And that can get knocked out of you a lot. But if you can just cast yourself back in your mind to the time at which you had that confidence, you are still the same person. And in fact, you've got more life lessons. You probably are much wiser. You can probably take the knocks an awful lot better. So just, you know, believe in yourself. Really just believe in yourself. And, you know, I think women do suffer from that lack of confidence more than men. And I think it's different for every woman. But we're asked to be a lot of things in our life, and we're expected to be good at those things. So I think it can just really tire you out a little bit, but you are entitled to enjoy your life and your career and just really believe in yourself. And if you don't believe in yourself, then come and see me and I'll believe in you.
Oh, bless you. That's lovely, Fee. Thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Good luck with the podcast.
Thank you, Fee Glover. We really appreciate your time for sharing your incredible broadcasting career. This Influential Women podcast is produced by Nikki Bannerman and Juliet Nichols. Keep listening for more podcasts and subscribe for free downloads on Apple Podcasts, formerly iTunes Podcasts, Stitcher and Audioboom.